I'm Ruth Steenerson today, too. And the name of our session today has to do with commitment versus fanaticism as far as these contraries that we're talking about in embracing the contraries, because we have our treasures in earthen vessels. I hope all of you have handouts. If you don't, there are some over on the table. We are going to be using our Bibles in case you want to get yours out of a sack or wherever it is. You won't be too disadvantaged if you don't have one along, I think, because I will be reading many of these verses out loud. I would like to have you do some of that, but I think it's simpler for the tape system if I do it, and so we'll handle it that way if you don't mind. How much of oneself does one have to give in order to be a committed follower of Jesus Christ? How seriously do we, if we wish to be such followers, need to take the evaluation by others of our commitment? Incidentally, there are handouts on the table there as you come in if you want to pick those up. When does commitment turn into fanaticism? How do we handle the fact that our commitment makes demands on the lives of other people, sometimes very drastically? How do we decide when the claims of Christ and what we do as our responsibility to others conflicts? I think there are many of us as believers who have to face those questions at some time or another. Some years ago, I did a series of devotionals for Christ in our home, and the series was a series of short character studies of biblical figures. And one of the figures I was using was Sarah. Now, Sarah is a most admirable figure in many ways, but I can't help thinking as I read that particular story that Abraham was slightly henpecked. And that Sarah very much had a mind of her own and didn't hesitate to use what technique she could to get her own way. And I had expressed that in one of these devotionals. I had an uncle who was a missionary in Madagascar and rather elderly by the time I did this. And when I saw him later on, I discovered, although he was very tactful, that he really hadn't liked my picture of Sarah very much. And it wasn't hard to understand why, because there had been that woman whom he loved, who had expected to spend her life in this country with her family around her, who was faced with the question of whether she would go with him to Madagascar. In other words, his commitment was making a real impact on her lives, on her life. And so it wasn't strange that he was disturbed with the idea that Sarah had her flaws, because after all, to her, she was like his wife Elizabeth, and that was important to him. I suppose one of the reasons for the Roman Catholic practice of having their clergy celibate had something to do with the fact that leaves its leadership free from many of those kinds of conflicts. That certainly we know that Protestant, Lutheran clergy, as well as many lay people, must face up to. What does our commitment to Jesus Christ mean in the lives of other people that we share life with? There are strong statements by New Testament writers about commitment, the degree of it that is called for, or the willingness to risk the results of our commitment. And I'd like to start our session out today by looking at some of the Bible verses that talk about that kind of commitment that is called for. And I've chosen the strong statements, although I certainly haven't captured all of them, because when we look at the play by Henrik Ibsen, Brand, we're going to certainly find that he makes strong statements when it comes to trying to decide how he handles his commitment in his particular life. There's been a real tendency, I think, in the history of the church and of individuals, when they face up to many of those statements of Jesus that call for the kind of obedience or the kind of commitment that goes against the grain of our popular society, our popular behavior. For instance, many of those in Matthew 5 turn the other cheek to say of Christ, but of course he didn't really mean it that way. I'm sure I'm not the only one who has heard that. I've heard people reacting to some of those strong statements with a sort of a rationale, well, he didn't really mean it, to be taken as strongly as it sounds. It's uncomfortable. Let's rationalize it. Let's evade it. Let's say that it really doesn't apply to us. One of my colleagues and I sat visiting someday about something that was happening in our church. And he was an adult confirmant. He didn't have very much of a church background. And whatever it was, I don't even remember the issue now that we were talking about, of some dissension in our church where Jesus had spoken on the subject very clearly. I happened to just quote that verse as something to think about. And he looked at me with kind of a troubled look on his face, and he said, you know, I have trouble with an awful lot of things Jesus says. And I think he was being very honest, and I think that if we are equally honest, we probably have said at times too, I have trouble with that. It calls for something that I'm not sure that I'm willing to give. Now, let's take a look at some of these New Testament statements, and we'll come back and see how we think they relate to some of these matters later on. The first verse I'm going to look at, and these will often be very close together, so if you find the place for one of them, we'll just move along to the other. In Matthew, the 6th chapter, verse 24, and many of you could quote the verse, I'm sure, without even looking it up. Matthew 6:24, no one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. Now, if we move along to chapter 7 and take a look at verses 13 and 14, we will find another statement that makes a strong claim. Enter in by the narrow gate, for the gate is wide and the way is easy that leads to destruction, and those who enter it are many. For the gate is narrow and the way is hard that leads to life, and those who find it are few. If you turn the page, at least in my RSV, to chapter 8, verses 21 and 22, we find another demanding statement. Another of the disciples said to him, Lord, let me go first and bury my father. But Jesus said to him, follow me and leave the dead to bury their own dead. Sounds like a pretty harsh statement, doesn't it? And it's one of those, I think, where we're very likely to say, but of course, he didn't really mean that. And maybe he did mean it in a particular context, of course. In chapter 10, verses 34 on for several verses, do not think, chapter 10, verse 34, do not think that I have come to bring peace on earth. I have not come to bring peace, but a sword. For I have come to set a man against his father, and a daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and a man's foes will be those of his own household. He who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me, and he who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me, and he who does not take his cross and follow me is not worthy of me. Then if we move ahead to chapter 16, you know, as I'm not stopping to comment on these, I'm just giving you the whole barrage at once. 16:24, then Jesus told his disciples, if any man would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. Then I'm going to move ahead to Luke chapter 14 and not even wait for you to catch up with me on verse 26. If anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yea, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Some of these verses are very relevant, I think, right in the minds of some of us right now who listen to Rob Wall talk about some of these matters in our Bible study period. In Acts, moving quite a ways ahead again, Acts 5:29, Peter and the apostles answered, "We must obey God rather than man." And then moving ahead to 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 12b, I won't find 1 Corinthians in Romans. 1 Corinthians 9, 12b, we endure anything rather than put an obstacle in the way of the gospel of Christ. You know, for some reason or other, I don't even remember having noticed that verse in the times I have read 1 Corinthians, but it's strong, isn't it? We endure anything rather than put an obstacle in the way of the gospel of Christ. Then moving ahead to Ephesians 5:11, take no part in the unfruitful works of darkness, but instead expose them. I think that's an interesting verse in a time in which we sort of think it's politically important to not withdraw ourselves from things. We've got to be in there and have our part. Ephesians 6, 12. For we are not contending against flesh and blood, but against the principalities, against the powers, against the world rulers of the present darkness, against the spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. Therefore, take the whole armor of God, that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand. And in Philippians 3:8, for his sake I have suffered the loss of all things, that I may count them as refuse, in order that I might gain Christ and be found in him. And then going back again to Matthew 5, before our first one even, just to remind us of some of these statements which we know so well. For instance, verse 39, I say to you, do not resist one who is evil. But if anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if anyone would sue you and take your coat, let him have your cloak as well. Down to verse 44, I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven. Well, these are just a few out of hundreds of verses in biblical writings that call for us to make a strong commitment to the teachings, the example, the cause of Jesus Christ. And I wanted us to have those in the back of our minds as we go on to talk about the matter of commitment and that troubling term fanaticism, which so easily can be misunderstood and which sometimes takes on very troubling meanings. The next thing I'd like to have you do is take a look at the questions at the bottom of the handout that I gave you for day three. Several of these we'll come back to, I think, and we'll touch as we get into Brand, but I'd like to have us start thinking about these. What distinctions can we make to help us distinguish in our day between real Christian commitment and fanaticism? Or should we even try to draw a distinction? Maybe it's something we should rather leave alone. This question isn't there, but it's important, I think. Is this matter of commitment strictly a private matter? Is this something I decide for myself and have no business even trying to evaluate for somebody else? The term fanaticism gets thrown around loosely. And I think oftentimes, particularly especially if we're used to working in a community or a profession or a world where people are very outspoken about what they think about people's commitment to their religious faith, it's very easy to hear that word used loosely. And to hear someone say, well, she's a real fanatic about religion. Now, maybe if we could track down the person and take a look, we might have a very different reaction. We might say that is a really committed person. And aren't we glad that he is a member of our church because his commitment is a very strong one. These words can be blurred together, and oftentimes the reaction to them is a very personal one. The second question asks, what is the contemporary attitude toward these words in our society? Well, generally, commitment's a good word, isn't it? But fanaticism, nobody would want to be thought a fanatic. That is definitely a word with a bad connotation. And the third question and the fourth, I think we leave because they aren't going to be terribly meaningful until we have talked about Brand. Now, let's stop with that first question. I'm reforming today. I forever in these sessions talk too much, which means nobody else gets to talk enough. And so I'm in the process of reforming. And so I'm going to stop right now and ask if you have something to throw out as far as that first question is concerned. How can we distinguish in our day or any day probably, between real Christian commitment and fanaticism? How do we draw a distinction between the two? Do you have some thinking on that that you'd share with us? Yes?
Well, I think of a fanatic as someone who tries to get everybody else to think like they do.
Mm-hmm. Now, incidentally, I'm not heckling. I just want to get at another side of the picture. So a person then who wants to get everybody to be a Christian, to think as they do about the Christian faith, is a fanatic. And you don't mean that at all.
For instance, if they are Jewish, and a Christian tries to make a Christian out of them, keeps at them all the time, I'd say that Christian is a fanatic.
So you're not saying if they give an invitation that that's a fanatic,
no.
But if they nag at it,
that's
keep
right.
at it, that's another matter. The person then who seeks to forcibly impose
right.
his beliefs on someone else. Someone had a hand here. Yes?
Well, just exactly what does fanaticism mean? Now, doesn't that mean overdoing something?
All right. And yes?
We have instances in the Bible where they tell us that we just cannot change people. They have to change themselves. And by our works shall they know us. And, so how do you draw the line?
That's the question. And I suppose here we need to distinguish something else too. We don't change people, but the Holy Spirit changes, working through the Word in our witness. But the change has to come, as Margaret implies, from something other than just what we say. Yes?
I don't think it has to do with the strength of belief or the strength of the principles on which one acts, but rather being imbalanced in them. Getting too much on one little aspect of something and everything else getting lost in the process.
Mm-hmm.
It's more a matter of keeping a balance.
Mm-hmm. You're saying, I think, that commitment is a balanced thing and that fanaticism is imbalanced.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yes.
Well, it seems to me where it's sort of a semantics type of thing, but would you say zealotry then is the same thing as a fanatic? Is that what you would put it?
I bet you if you're on the other side from the zealot, that's exactly what you think about him.
I mean, right. Isn't usually a fanatic someone who's really over-pushy on than something other than what we believe?
Mm-hmm. It is going to be related to a matter we believe, isn't it? Because the reaction will depend
totally on that.
If we
agree totally with the person that other people are labeling a fanatic, we probably wouldn't consider them a fanatic.
No, we just say they were committed to the cause.
Yeah.
But, all right. Now, I put down some questions because I've learned how fast the time goes on this, and some of them we've already touched. But I wonder, when we talk about making distinctions, if we're not talking about such things as, is the act or what the statement or whatever we're talking about, is it self-serving? or is it serving Christ and others? I think that may have a significance. Are the results of the behavior we label fanatical, do they fall on the person who is supposedly being fanatical, or does he cause them to fall on other people so that he escapes the results, but other people instead suffer? How does love fit into the picture? This is a very important question in Brand, because everyone who looks at Brand must realize that here is a man who is totally committed to what he believes about the Christian faith and his responsibility to it. But people look at him again and again and say, but where is love in the picture? Is the behavior of fanaticism, does it attract or repel? That's a dangerous question, because as was suggested over here, for on the other side, we may well think that the behavior is repelling. Well, on the other hand, if we agree with a person, we may well think that it is attractive. Is the behavior that we're judging judgmental, or is it merciful? And here's another question that is very significant in the story of Brand. Is the object of its activity worthwhile? There are questions one can set up and look at in terms of distinguishing between these terms, but I really don't want to spend any more time on it because there are some other things that I'd like to get at too. I think sometimes we even need to watch, not only as individuals, but as religious groups, about our tendency to evaluate each other or other groups in terms of how we see the commitment of these other people. In the state that I come from, I'm on one of the ecumenical organizations in the state, and there are people from probably around 20 different judicatories or religious groups that are on that in that group. And one of the things that has really disturbed me over the several years that I've been a member of that group is how quickly the groups tend to brand those that are at some distance from them in terms of whether they have a strong commitment or whether they go too far or are rather fanatical. I have noticed at times, for instance, that it is assumed that those who call themselves evangelicals think that those of us in the mainline churches don't have commitment enough. And then those of us in the mainline churches turn around with something to say that those who are in the evangelical stream of religious thought are committed, overcommitted in certain areas. I think you can see this happening sometimes between traditionalists and the charismatics. One group looks at the other in terms of how they evaluate their commitment and say they have too little, or they have too much, or they have an imbalanced kind of commitment in some particular area. I think there's a danger, not only that we misjudge each other and each other's groups and in the process are hard on love within the Christian community, but there's also a danger that those of us who work with a good deal of our time in the work of the church, we professionalize our service to Christ and to the church in such a way that we adopt the measure of commitment that is required in business, in the professions, and say that we don't want to go beyond that. After all, why should anyone expect us to go beyond what our colleagues work with in these other fields? A rationalistic, secular society may admire, but oftentimes be very skeptical of or suspicious of real Christian commitment. To many people in our world, it's a very hard thing to understand. They find it perfectly all right and handleable to deal with nominal church membership, but they find it very difficult to deal with radical discipleship. In fact, any time you get that word radical in, you frighten off a large number of people, don't you? Because after all, who would want to be radical? And yet, and again, I think we've had some wonderful instances of this being brought out here at Holden just this week. Unless you're willing to be radical, there are probably many things that need doing for the cause of Christ that you're going to back off from and be afraid of and never want to tangle with. The kind that has self-denial and obedience to the prophetic word often is dangerous for people in many church-related vocations, and they don't want to be known as radicals. Maybe down underneath they have a sense that they should, or we have a sense that we should, and yet at the same time it's hard to handle in the world we live in, because this world celebrates the golden mean. And it gets great respect in our society. We're suspicious of anything that is total. Well, she's gone too far in that direction. Or, well, he comes on pretty strong on that, doesn't he? Okay, now for Brand. Now, I'm assuming that some of you probably have read Brand, but probably most of you haven't. And consequently, I'm going to act as though you don't know the story and try to make it clear by a few quotations, some of which are on our handout, and others, again, that I will read from the text itself. Brand, who is a Norwegian Lutheran pastor, not in the history of the United States, but a Norwegian pastor of a Lutheran persuasion in Norway. And there are two things that come to be very quickly obvious about Brand as Ibsen portrays him. He has a little catchphrase, all or nothing. And he uses it again and again as he makes his demand on the people in his parish, on his family, on others that he comes in contact with. The words get to be used many times in the play, all or nothing, to describe what he sees as necessary or commitment if one is to be a believer, a Christian. Now, Brand is a fascinating but also a rather frightening person, because Brand no doubt has thought as we have thought about the consequences of our Christian faith being all or nothing in its commitment. But Brand has decided to go with all the consequences. He is not going to back away from it, says, well, I can't really go that far. He has said to himself, and he keeps saying to others, that Christian commitment is a matter of all or nothing. If you're not willing to give it all, forget it, because it isn't going to do any good anyway. Now, Brand also has a second problem, and I don't know if non-Lutheran readers of this particular play would have the trouble with it that we Lutherans do, but he has a second problem. He's Lutheran, but to him, salvation is through exertion of the will rather than through grace. In other words, it's how much you're willing to buy into all or nothing, and how much you are willing to go along with that, that determines whether you are a Christian or not. Brand is strong meat, oftentimes, for those of us who have all our lives been encouraged to believe that if we fail, if our will is not strong enough, there is forgiveness, there is mercy available. To Brand, a God who would by grace redeem the half-hearted, put up with the compromiser, would be a weakling. And to him, a person who would withhold anything from his or her commitment to God and then expect to be forgiven because of what Christ did on the cross, who doesn't begin to have an understanding of God. So, you can see, we're dealing with a very strong figure here, but we're not dealing with one who is necessarily all that easy to put up with. And he's a good illustration, I think, of the tendency we often have to draw distinctions between the commitment that we can go along with because it's moderate and sensible to us, and the kind of fanaticism, that's what we'd probably call Brand in many ways, that causes us trouble. Now, the setting of the play Ibsen is such that you're not going to find it produced on a good many university theater plays or in summer theater stock plays. It happens in the wild mountains of Norway. They're high, and the area is glacial. It's avalanche country. I suppose, really, if we want a setting for putting on the play Ibsen, this would make a wonderful setting. Maybe somebody should go to work on putting on Ibsen at Holden. Brand, at the beginning of the story, is walking through part of this glacial area. It's a dangerous area because there are avalanches that are likely at any time. He's walking through on his way to his hometown. And he has a coincidental meeting with a man and a woman who are also walking through that area. And the man turns out to be a former schoolmate of Brand's. He has, with his girlfriend, just been to the betrothal feast. And this couple now is on their way down. They're going the same way that he's not going to any marriage feast. He is going to a burial feast. To a burial feast? Who is to be buried? The God that you have just called yours, Brand says. Agnes thinks this sounds strange, and she just assumed they leave him behind. The man wants to know what he means by this idea of going to the burial feast of God. And Brand says he is going to the God of every, the burial feast of every dull and earthbound slave shall be shrouded and coffined for all to see and lowered into his grave. It's time, you know. He has been ailing for 1,000 years. Brand, you're ill. No, I am well and strong as mountain pine or juniper. It is our time, our generation that is sick and must be cured. All you want is to flirt and play and laugh, to do lip service to your faith, but not to know the truth, to leave your suffering to someone who they say died for your sake. He died for you, so you are free to dance. Well, the couple is troubled by what he is saying. I think they probably know underneath that what he is saying is that the church for the last 1,000 years has had trouble with commitment, but it's too strong for them. And he goes on to tell them what he thinks believers should be in his day. Be holy what you are, not half and half. Everyone now is a little of everything, a little solemn on Sundays, a little respectful to tradition, makes love to his wife after Saturday supper because his father did the same, a little gay at feasts, a little lavish in giving promises, but niggardly in fulfilling them, a little of everything, a little sin, a little virtue, a little good, a little evil, the one destroys the other, and every man is nothing. Well, the character of Brand, I suspect, has the strength that he does in Ibsen's play because there is always a measure of truth to what Brand says. There is a way in which what Brand says describes the church of every day and some of the people of the church of every day. The other man is an artist who has painted a picture of God, or what he imagines to be God, and Brand says, show me this God of yours. You're an artist, you've painted him, I hear. He's old, isn't he? Some of you, I'm sure, know J.V. Phillips' book, Your God is Too Small. And you may remember there how he brings out the idea that he asks groups of young people with whom he is working about God's age. Is he young or old? And everybody immediately says, old. You know, he's kindly but severe enough to frighten children into bed. Did you give him slippers? I hope you allowed him spectacles and a skull cap. And again, you notice in Brand's evaluation of how he thinks Einar would paint God, that does help to paint the picture that many people have of God. And Brand goes on, you separate life from faith and doctrine. You do not want to live your faith. For that you need a God who will keep one eye shut. That God is getting feeble like the generation that worships him. Mine is a storm, where yours is a gentle wind. Inflexible, where yours is deaf. All loving, not all doting. And the couple are glad to separate from Bran pretty soon because he's not a very comfortable person as he goes to this burial feast for their god and advises Eivind to paint him with crutches. I go to lay him in his grave. Well, the people go on down to the waterside where the ship is. It will take Einar and Agnes away. Brand, by another path, comes down to the same place. And there the mayor and the other officials of the town are distributing food to starving people. The fishing has been bad. The food supply is almost gone. And everyone who comes into the village is encouraged to give so that food may be purchased for the people. And significantly, Brand will not contribute. He says to do that is only to weaken people. And he would like people strong, those who survive, that is, providing they do with a lack of food. As they are arguing about this, a woman comes tearing down the hillside onto the scene, and she is frantic because one of her children has just died from starvation. And her husband, her child has died because her husband, grown so frantic with the need to feed his family, has killed one of the children. And father then has grown frantic. The woman comes trying to find somebody who would come and give him absolution so that he can be willing to live. Nobody is willing to go out on the water because it's very rough because of the storm that is going on. And Brand, of course, is the one who gets into the boat and says, now come on, who's coming with me so that we can go and provide this man's need? Well, the mayor says he doesn't belong to my district. And a good many others wouldn't get in that boat for anything. And Brand can't understand it. I only need one man to bail and work the boat, the sail. Come, one of you, you gave food just now. Won't anyone give his life? And of course the answer to that is you can't ask a thing like that. The one, interestingly enough, who chooses to get into the boat with Brand is the woman he had been speaking with her fiancé up on the mountain. She has been so impressed by what Brand has said that she gets into the boat and she says, I will come. And off they go to take care of the need of the man for absolution. The people so come to admire Brand because of what he does here that when he returns to the village, they plead with him to become their pastor. That, after all, they say, is the sort of priest we need. And they find that Brand is not very willing to accede to what they ask. He says, ask anything of me, but not that. I have a greater calling. I must speak to the world. Where the mountains shut one in, a voice is powerless. Who buries himself in a pit when the broad fields beckon? Who plows the desert when fertile soil awaits him? No, he will not stay and be their pastor. But they continue to plead. He continues to say no. He says, I have dared to take upon myself the salvation of man. Now, that's a very significant statement because he is beginning to set himself up as whom?
God.
He's beginning to set himself up as God. He says, that is my work. I must leave this narrow valley. And he goes on, but eventually he does give in. And he stays. Agnes catches his vision and is willing to stay with him They are married, and so the two of them will stay together to pastor in this community. Onto the scene comes Brand's mother, a mother with whom he is from whom he is estranged, and he is not ready to become reconciled to her. She admires, she's proud of the fact that he is a priest, and yet at the same time she's angry with him for taking on that crossing over the fjord. She says, "You must live to carry on my name. And all I've lived and worked for, you'll be rich, you know, one day." "I see. So that's why you've come to look for me." And she's afraid of him. She draws back. "Don't come near me. I'll hit you with my stick." And she pleads with him to be reconciled with her, not to throw his life away, but pass on the name to sons and grandsons. And there's much that explains their relationship, which I won't take time for now. But at any rate, she finally tells him, "I made my son a priest. When my time comes, you must look after my soul in return for your inheritance." And Brand is unbending. He says, "You have squandered the soul God lent you. You were born in his image, and you have dragged it in the mire. That is your debt. Where will you go when God demands his own?" "Where shall I go? Where?" And the argument goes on with him telling her, "You must repent or perish." And his statement to her is, "If you feel drawn toward the light and wish to see me, send, and I will come." And he will come, he says, as a priest to shrive her. "But I shall come in the hour of your repentance. Everything that binds you to this world you must renounce and go naked to your grave. Ask anything else, not what I love most." And so she backs away again to say to him about her money, "If I must lose all I have, at least let me keep it as long as I can." And so there is no reconciliation between the two. And he comes back again to his errand to bury the kind of God that the people of his country and his he believes his parish worship. And then he deals with Agnes, who has decided she's going to stay with him and be his wife. And he says to her, "Young woman, think carefully before you decide. Locked between mountain and mountain, shadowed by crag and peak, shut in the twilight of this ravine, my life will flow like a sad October evening." You see, he's not going to be the savior of the world at this point. He's going to live in this little community with its big crags around them. And he says, "Remember, I am stern in my demands. I require all or nothing." Who has the right to require all or nothing? God?
God.
Or Brand? No half measures. There is no forgiveness for failure. It may not be enough to offer your life. Your death may be needed also. And so the second act ends. By the time the third act opens, it's 3 years later. And Brand and Agnes are married. They have a small child. They live in this dark, narrow valley where their child is pale and sickly. And Agnes thinks they must leave because surely their child will die. But Brand says, "Oh, God would never do that to somebody who is as committed as I am to his cause." And so he's waiting for word from the mother who is still alive. And he and Agnes talk about things that are significant to his trying to shape her to the kind of believer he thinks is the only possible kind. Agnes has problems. Your love is hard. Where would you caress you? Where you would caress you bruise? Many have shrunk from us at your demand of all or nothing. He knows that would happen. And he talks about the possibility of failure in what they attempt to do, that you cannot will be forgiven, that you will not never. There is but one law for all men, no cowardly compromise. The doctor comes, the doctor who is very aware of what's happening to the little boy in this dark setting, and that he is ill. The doctor comes on his way to go to see the mother, who is very ill. Now, the doctor has made no commitment of all or nothing, but he is the one who has enough concern to go to Bran's mother when the son will not. You're a hard man, the doctor says. I've struggled all the way across the moor through mist and sleet, although I know she pays like a pauper. I came as soon as I heard she needed me. And Bran says, well, you can tell her if she's ready to meet my conditions, I'll come to her too. And the doctor looks at him and says, in your ledger, your credit account for strength of will is full, but priest, your love account is a white virgin page. And more and more this comes to be the kind of brand that we see. Now there gets to be a bargaining session between messengers from the mother who come to say, she says that she'll give up half her money. Brand says, forget it. The next messenger says that she'll give 9/10 of all her wealth. And Bran says, not all? No. She knows my answer. No priest, no sacrament. And Agnes clings to him, but she says, Bran, sometimes you frighten me. You flame like the sword of God. And Agnes talks of people are weak sometimes. Yet from this blind, stumbling generation, you demand all or nothing. The only thing that can sort of shake Brand is a fear that his child would die. He's been sure that wouldn't happen because, after all, he has pledged all or nothing. And yet he can't help thinking, if he should test me like he tested Abraham, and he can't really believe that God could do it that way. Well, the doctor visits the mother, who eventually dies. The doctor says she mumbles in her death, God is not so cruel as my son. And the doctor suggests that he should have a different kind of thing to judge by, to rule by. Says its first commandment should be humane, which of course he doesn't agree with at all. The doctor says, well, your child will die. Another winter here will kill him. And he wonders that Bran can be so merciless toward your flock, so lenient toward yourself when it comes to, you know, kind of shaking on this particular point, but not any others. You told us that God sent you here to fight for us, that it's better for a man to die than to betray his calling. Well, as they begin to, as Agnes and Brand talk, she admires what is happening. Brand is successful as a pastor in the area. And she knows that, if I could only find my place on my notes, I'd do better here. She knows that he considers himself successful and that other people look at him as that too. And she says, everything has gone the way it should be, except that their church is too small. And Bran picks up on that right away. That must be it. Their church isn't big enough really to inspire people to be what they could be. And so he decides to take the money that he has gotten in the inheritance from his mother and to build a new church. And it's going to be the biggest and the best and demonstrate how one's commitment to God must be a matter of all or nothing. Well, the church is built, and one would expect that Bran should be happy, but he is anything but fulfilled, even by the building of this church. There is very little that will fulfill him. The child dies, and Agnes grieves and weeps in her grief. And her husband tells her again and again, you've got to go all or nothing. And if you grieve like this, it's nothing. You've got to put that aside. Agnes finds a few of the little clothes of the child and packs them away. And she gets them out to look at once in a while. And her husband virtually says, that's idolatry. You've got to get rid of all, or you've got to give all and get rid of this kind of thing. And she holds on to the little crocheted cap of the child. Into their Christmas Eve comes a gypsy woman who has a child without clothes. And she pleads for clothes, and Agnes gives her almost everything that the little child that she bore has had, and holds back in her hand the little cap. And Bran says, you've got to give it up. It's all or nothing. And eventually she does. But at the same time, you sense that her sanity almost is beginning to shake. Bran defines the kind of a God that he sees and must see as, I must see him great and strong, as great as heaven. She has suggested maybe he should look at God as a tender father. But Agnes's duty, according to Brand, is to give him love. You must give me love. Your task is not small. And Agnes says, the God you taught me to know is a warrior God. How dare I go to him with my small sorrow? Everything here is too big for me. You're calling the mountain that hangs over us our grief, our memories. Only the church is too small. And that is the point at which he decides he will go ahead with his inheritance and build the church. Eventually, the church is built, the idea of Brand is, of course, that now all will be well. It's not well with Agnes. Agnes has come to be more and more unable to follow where he wants to lead. And Bran says, you are my wife. I have the right to demand that you shall devote yourself wholly to our calling. Remember, as we mentioned in the question at the very beginning, when our commitment impinges on somebody else, that can sometimes be a painful moment. Well, by the time the next act comes, the church is built. It's the day that there is going to be the big celebration, and the provost has come in order to take part in the festivities and to present to Brand a decoration. And everybody seems to think it's a great day, except Brand. Brand that morning sits trying to play the organ in the church, and all he can get out of it is dissonance. There is no harmony that will come anywhere. And he's troubled that the people are not as happy about the new church as he thinks they should be. And they're not. They love the old church. And the old church, when it came down, took something of them along with them. And Bran cannot understand. They are afraid, as though they had been summoned to elect a new god. But the fright is there. And he wonders at the sounds. I lifted the voice of the organ in prayer, but it was thrown back broken, like the note of a cracked and rusted bell. It was as if the Lord God stood enthroned on high in the choir and cast it down in his wrath, refusing my position. Everybody praises me, but their words burn me. And the more he looks at the church, the more he comes to believe even this church is too small. The church as it stands is small. To hide that would be to lie. Well, the mayor says, what in the world is it that you're complaining about? You're to receive a decoration, the Grand Cross. And the provost says everything is going well. The only thing, he does have one complaint about Brand, and that is that Brand treats everybody in his parish as though they're individuals, rather than treating them all the same. And I suppose there's a comment getting to be made about the state church idea there. The surest way to destroy a man is to turn him into an individual, the provost says. Well, Brand cannot see the sense of what is happening and grows more and more troubled. And then Eivind comes back on the scene. He's been gone for a while. And Eivind has gone through a religious conversion of, we would suppose, probably more the fundamentalist type. It's been a deeply emotional experience. He is not interested in talking to Brand. He says, I need no priest. I have found peace. And as he Brand questions him, Einar tells how God did this. He gave him a lust for cards and dice, and therefore he came to realize that he was so wicked that he needed to get salvation. Now Einar is on his way to Africa to be a missionary. Brand tells him that Agnes is dead. Her grave grows green by the side of the little boy. And Einar goes off, Brand disturbed because he couldn't make Einar see his way, but nevertheless still convinced of his own way. Finally, Brand takes the keys to the new church and throws them into the river. It may be all ready to use, but as far as Brand is concerned, it has nothing to offer. The thing that stands here is a lie. And he invites his people to show themselves with fresh children's faces in the great church of life up the mountainside. And he begins to move toward the mountain. The people begin to follow him toward the mountain. The mayor and the provost are very alarmed. He will take our people from us. And they are totally bewildered by the situation. The provost says he'll never be a bishop now. And Brand moves on, calling the people to come with him. And they go up the mountainside in a kind of a religious frenzy, ready to follow him, all or nothing, as he goes into the mountain to this church of life. Climb onward, climb, he says. But in the next scene, a man says, wait, my old father is tired. Remember the Bible verse that talked about the let the dead bury their dead? Another says, I've eaten nothing since yesterday. Give us food, quench our thirst. The path's too steep, we'll never get there by nightfall. My child is sick. Water, we're thirsty. Perform a miracle, Father. A miracle. Tell us, priest, will the battle be hard? Will it be long? Will it be bloody? Will we have to travel? Will we have to be brave? There's no question of our lives being endangered. What will be my share of the reward? My son will not die, will he, Father? Will victory be ours by Tuesday? And so the complaints build and build. And finally, when Brand says, how long will you have to fight? Until you die. What will it cost? Everything you hold dear. Your reward? A new will. A new will cleansed and strong. A new faith, integrity of spirit, a crown of thorns. That will be your reward. They think he has betrayed them. He wants us to die to save people who haven't been born. Kill him. And so the mob chases Brand into the hills, and hit by the stones, but not incapacitated, he goes on by himself. And the crowd goes home, particularly when the mayor comes with news that a huge shoal of fish has come into the fjord. Now then they can go home and there will be food for everybody. Later on, we find the mayor tells them that only as a lie in order to get them to turn around. And so Bran looks at them going and says, I see the mark of Cain on every brow. I see where you will all end. Stone him, kill him. And the last scene has Bran among the hills, still puzzling over the people's reaction. Someone once died to save their souls, so nothing more is required of them. And as he goes on, a figure materializes out of the clouds in the rain, and it's a figure of Agnes. And she gives him news of his mother, of the child, and tells him that there are three words he has to blot out, and those words must be forgotten, all or nothing. And he shrieks, that? And of course, this is something that he cannot see himself doing. I'm leaving out several important characters here for those of you who know the play, simply to save time. But a gypsy woman in the hills looks at him and says, you're the big man, the biggest of all. Bran says, I used to think I was. Let me see your hands. My hands? They're scarred with nails. There's blood in your hair. The thorn's teeth have cut your forehead. You've been on the cross. Now, she is mistaking him, you notice, for Christ. My father told me it happened long ago and far away, but now I see he was deceiving me. I know you. You are the Savior man. And now Bran has to begin to realize how serious his claim to act like the Savior man has come to be. And he weeps toward the end of the play, O Jesus, I have called upon your name. Why did you never receive me into your bosom? You passed close by me, but you never touched me. Let me hold one poor corner of your garment and wet it with my tears of true repentance. And the woman says, what's the matter? You're crying, hot tears. The ice in my memory is thawing into tears. You're melting the snow on my church roof. The ice priest's cloak is sliding from his shoulders. For the first time, Vrand is beginning to seem to somebody like a human with human needs.